And welcome back to Coast. We are going to open up the third secret door in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. And who's behind the secret door? Let's open the door and see who walks through. Well, hello there.
Well, hello, George.
How are you?
Well, reasonably okay.
Now, this is going to be intriguing, too. My gosh. You guys have been doing a great job stumping me. Have you been on the program often?
I don't know what you mean by often, but more than once.
And generally, we'll talk about what kind of subject?
Maybe aliens, maybe UFOs, maybe putting more lubricant on that door.
Yeah, that was kind of creaky, wasn't it? And creepy.
So, George, do you have any idea?
Not yet.
Oh.
I'm working. This is tough. Now, is this a real change in your voice?
Well, I hope not, actually, because if it is, a lot of people are going to be really dismayed when I talk to them.
There's a clue there, but I didn't get it. Sound a little like Ronald Reagan, but I know you're not him.
Well, no. I'm afraid the Ronald isn't around.
Gosh, I'm going to give up. I'm 0-3. This is horrible. Who are you?
Well, I'm Seth.
Seth Shostak. Oh, my gosh, my SETI man.
Yes.
That was great.
Well, I don't think it was great, George, but...
You stumped me.
Yeah, I guess. You know, has it been a total of three doors then?
You're the third door.
Well, I would think that by now you should have found one with a bedroom set behind it, or maybe a new car.
Or something. My gosh, this is like Wheel of Fortune or something like that. My God, good job.
Well, your producer, Tom, said if I had a voice to use it. I don't have a voice, but anyhow.
And you know what? For me to guess, I have to be in that mindset of thinking about that person and that genre, and I just never would have thought you would have been behind the secret door.
Well, I figure you've had more than 1,000 guests. So,
at least.
Yes. So maybe not so surprising. It's hard to pick them out if they're not, you know, maybe on television it would be easier. I don't know.
Well, now, while we got you, we're going to take calls with you in about 20 minutes or so. But what did you think of the government's June 25th report?
Yeah, well, I think I was asked to comment in advance of the report.
Oh, really?
Yes. What I thought it was going to be. And I said, well, I figured that it's going to be very ambiguous and probably not satisfy anybody. And after I read the report, I figured it was pretty ambiguous and didn't seem to satisfy anybody. I mean, I think, you know, everybody walked away thinking, well, it didn't tell me anything I didn't already suspect. And it certainly didn't clear anything up.
It really did. They didn't admit anything. They didn't make anything look good or bad, but, I was a little disappointed.
Yeah, I was too. And in particular, you know, they say in there that they had examined something like 144 cases, reports, whatever they are, incidents. They, you know, investigated those carefully. And of those 144, I think it was, they could only explain one. That's a pretty low hit rate. And I think that the Defense Intelligence Agency should go out and, you know, recruit new people.
Absolutely. Is it conceivable with SETI that if there's an alien race in a spacecraft circling the planet and they were beaming things to us, would you be able to pick that up?
Well, in general, no, to be quite honest. I mean, you know, we point our telescopes, whether they're radio telescopes, big antennas, or optical telescopes with mirrors or lenses, maybe point them in specific directions, you know, like that star system over there, because we know that it has planets.
And right,
so. Right. So if something's flying around in the atmosphere, if you know, 5 miles up or whatever, and then this is going to fly right by, you're never going to see it. So if they're doing that, you better hope that there's some amateur astronomers who happen to see it, or, you know, just people go out at night and look up and say, whoa, that doesn't belong there.
Good point. Give us an update, Seth, on SETI. What's going on?
Well, SETI is actually sort of in a high gear these days because there are things going on. The Allen Telescope Array, we've talked about that before.
Sure.
It's getting getting new receivers, and that may not sound so interesting, but, you know, that's kind of where the rubber meets the road when it comes to radio telescopes and SETI. And this is thanks to a gentleman down in Southern California, even farther south than you, down in La Jolla, by the name of Franklin Antonio. Anyhow, he's interested in this project, and so he is funding the construction of some new receivers that'll make the whole
fantastic
better. Yeah, fantastic. So that's good.
Is there any interest from folks like Jeff Bezos or anything like that?
No, there's not. Although, you know, when the Arecibo telescope collapsed, what was it, in November or something?
Yeah.
Like that, you know, I was urged by Bob Zubrin, who may have been on your show.
I don't know. Many times.
Well, Zubrin called me up and said, you got to get hold of Elon Musk.
Uh-huh.
And see if he'll, you know, fund rebuilding that telescope. And he was interested in learning more, but it turned out that nobody seems to believe that you could rebuild it in any, you know, it's hard to rebuild it, and it would cost $100 million. And if you're going to spend $100 million, you might as well build something different.
Yeah, that's right.
That telescope is, you know, more than a half century old. So there may be something to replace Arecibo, but it won't look like Arecibo.
My first interview with you, for folks who might not remember, was when I was in St. Louis as the Nighthawk, and you were in Puerto Rico right by the Arecibo telescope, and
yep.
I was doing my local show, and I interviewed you while you were there, and it was just fantastic. Remember that?
No, I certainly do. In fact, I can sort of picture the situation. I was sitting sort of across from the table with all the candy bars, and we were talking about various places that we might be pointing that antenna.
Yep, absolutely. And then, of course, had you done Coast to Coast with Art before I came on?
Yes, I had, because I was in my office. I don't remember exactly which year it was. It was in the, you know, in the 1990s, I believe.
Right. It had to be in those years.
Yeah, in the early parts of the 1990s. And Art Bell actually just called me up at work, and he said, look, I'd like you to come on my show. And that's how it happened.
Okay, perfect. So SETI continues. Is it getting any NASA funding at all anymore?
Not yet. Not yet. There are studies that are funded by NASA, studies of, for example, what might be good evidence for an extraterrestrial civilization, what are called techno-signatures, which sounds like a lot of Greek to me, actually. But techno-signatures, anything that you would say, well, that doesn't look natural, so, you know, that's evidence of aliens or something of that ilk. And it could be, you know, radio signals or flashing lasers, or it could just be something that some advanced society has built, you know, that's so big that you can actually see it from far away. Any of these things might be techno-signatures.
We're talking with Seth Shostak from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, a incredible, incredible organization that has been looking for how many years now?
Well, the SETI Institute was actually founded in 1984, but the SETI enterprise goes back to 1960.
Wow. Was that the idea of Frank Drake's?
Yeah, he did the first experiment. I mean, there were other people who had sort of outlined what would be a good experiment, you know, from a theoretical point of view. These were guys that ended up at Cornell. They published something in 1959, but Frank Drake didn't know about that. He just did his experiment in 1960, on the basis of his own thinking about this matter, and it turned out it pretty much agreed with the other guys.
Scientists are talking about rebuilding Arecibo. Do you think it's conceivable?
Well, as I say, you know, building the original antenna at Arecibo is not on. The Chinese have an even bigger one that's basically a Chinese version of Arecibo, but it's, you know, almost twice the diameter, so it's a lot bigger. There's no point in building Arecibo again the way it was built in the very early 1960s. But it's a good site. It's a place where they've been careful to keep all interference down to a low level. So they're talking about possibly building an array of antennas there that in many ways would be better than the old Arecibo dish.
We're going to take calls with Seth in about 20 minutes or so make sure you're part of the program. Do you know Harvard's Avi Loeb, the professor?
Yes, I do. In fact, I had some interaction with him, well, in the past couple of weeks, because, as you know, he's got a new project.
He's got the Galileo Project, and he is serious about extraterrestrial life out there.
Well, he is. He's certainly making waves, and I don't want to make this about me, but I was asked by Scientific American to write a short opinion piece.
On him?
On the Project Galileo. Was this a good idea, or was this just a waste of, well, he's gotten, what, $1.7 million so far?
That's good starting cash.
It is, and it apparently started very rapidly. So anyhow, what I wrote was, yes, you know, I didn't think that they were going to find anything, but on the other hand, you know, it takes somebody like Avi Loeb to do an experiment that people will at least, you know, give credence to.
Absolutely.
Because he's a reputable guy.
Well, you put Harvard behind a guy's name, people listen.
Yeah, and I can tell you, George, he's a very smart cookie, no doubt about it. So it's, it's an interesting project. I have to say that after that, I was actually asked by Avi Loeb to be on the Science Advisory Board, but he knows that I'm skeptical about all this. But on the other hand, you know, nobody else could do this, right? People without the reputation.
I think you'd be perfect for this.
I'm not speaking about me, but I mean, nobody other than Avi Loeb could have taken an initiative like this and gotten away with it.
Explain what the Galileo Project is, Seth.
Well, my understanding is that it's sort of a two-pronged thing. To begin with, they're going to use the new Rubin telescope, the Rubin Observatory. This is a telescope being built down in Chile, and it isn't complete yet. But when it is complete, it will be able to survey the entire sky essentially every 4 days or so, right? So anything that changes, you will see. And, you know, that's not the way astronomy works today. It will have the biggest, you know, CCD sensor of any telescope in the world. So, you know, it's kind of all the sky, not quite all the time, but a lot of the time. So he wants to use that to look for things like a Oumuamua.
That strange object, whatever that is.
Yeah, right, because he has a radical idea about what a Oumuamua is. Most of my astronomy friends who know anything about asteroids say it's an asteroid, but Avi points out some things that make him think that it's maybe a little bit of alien hardware. Anyhow, he's going to do that. That's one half.
I mean, you categorically believe that there is extraterrestrial life out there. You just don't believe it's come here yet. Correct?
Exactly. But the other half of his experiment is actually designed to find things that are here, not even far away, like Oumuamua was never closer than about 100 million miles, maybe closer to 200 million miles from Earth. But the other part of the experiment is to build pairs of small telescopes around the world that are just looking up at the night sky. And if you have two of them separated by, whatever, 10 feet or something, then you can determine how far away anything you see is. And that's what's lacking from the UFO reports. Nobody knows how far away these things are.
Well, that's absolutely true. And what would you say in your career with SETI, and you've been there all those years, what's been the most fascinating moment for you? Was it that wow signal?
Well, the wow signal, believe it or not, you wouldn't think there would be anything older than my tenure with SETI, but that actually is. I think the wow signal was 1974. In any case, that was before I was involved with SETI. But during the SETI years, I guess probably in 1997 when we got a signal that we thought might be the real thing, and we've talked about that, but, you know, that was pretty exciting. That was a memorable evening.
Ohio State University picked that up, right?
No, that was the wow signal, but this signal we picked up.
Oh, yours, yeah.
Yeah, the signal we picked up, we were using an antenna in Green Bank, West Virginia. So we picked it up. It looked, you know, passed all the tests, making it look like it was really extraterrestrial, and it was obviously a transmitter because the signal was, you know, one spot on the radio dial. Anyhow, for about 24 hours, we thought maybe, you know, maybe we were going to be in all the papers. And in fact, the newspapers did start calling, but it turned out it was not ET.
What would the signal generally sound like if it was coming from an extraterrestrial race?
Well, of course, you don't know what the information would be, but they'd be sending bits of information. So listening to it wouldn't be very interesting. It would be like, you know, listening to, I don't know, the television signal coming in and not converting it to pictures or anything like that. But the kind of instruments that we use for SETI, you know, they throw most of the signal away. They couldn't find it, actually. They're not sensitive enough. What they look for are what are called carrier waves, very narrow band signals. So if you heard one of those and you converted it to audio, it would sound like a flute playing one note, you know. So not very interesting. And, of course, there'd be a lot of noise due to various instrumental effects. So it would be like listening to a flautist, if that's the word, a flautist playing, I don't know, middle C while standing next to Niagara Falls.
There are objects in the universe, planetary objects and celestial objects, that make noise because NASA has released some audio of these things. How do they do this?
Yeah, well, that was actually a puzzle. They do make noise. Of course, the sun makes radio noise, right? We've known that for a long time.
Yeah.
But planets like Jupiter and Saturn that have, you know, big magnetic fields, and they make noise basically because of the electrons, the elementary particles that fly around in the magnetic fields of these planets. The entire Milky Way makes radio noise basically for the same reason. And in fact, that was the first radio noise detected coming from the cosmos and not from, you know, your local radio station. That was back in the 1930s. And it was a guy at, you know, Bell Telephone, at Bell Labs, actually. He was, you know, trying to find out why transatlantic radio communications were sometimes disturbed. And it turned out that there were radio waves coming from the Milky Way.
We're with Seth Shostak. He was our third Secret Door guest, and I missed that. I'm 0 for 3 today. That's unprecedented. We're going to take calls in just a few moments here with Seth, so get ready to ask him a question or two about space and science and stuff. You know, you've been on since the late Stanton Friedman passed on, but I'll always remember that debate you two had. That was fantastic.
Yeah, well, I have to say, there are a lot of people that remember that debate because they like to write me about it.
Still?
It's too late to help me or him.
That's amazing. What's the future hold for SETI for this project?
Well, I think that the future is, as I say, looking brighter because there are a lot of things that are, you know, now becoming possible. We are building new telescopes. We're building these new receivers. That will make a big difference for the Allen Telescope Array. There's also a plan to use the Very Large Array, which, you know, some of the listeners may have seen. This is the one down in New Mexico. It is in a fair number of movies, actually. It was in Contact. It's 27 antennas spread out over the desert floor there. And, you know, it's doing astronomy research, traditional astronomy, if you will. But while it's doing astronomy, you know, you can siphon off, if you will, a different feed from the, you know, a different set of earphones, if you will, from that telescope, all 27 antennas, and look at those, hoping to find the kind of signal that SETI is looking for. So you can do SETI at the same time that somebody else is studying a galaxy or, you know, a quasar, or even, you know, planets and stuff like that. So that will be very exciting because it will result in a lot of observation.
How did SETI get the late Paul Allen from Microsoft interested?
Well, to be honest, I wasn't there, so I didn't see it. But I do know that Jill Tarter, who works at the SETI Institute, went up and talked with him. And he was already, I think, inclined to help support SETI because he was one of the five people that was called up when the government canceled NASA SETI back in 1993. There was a fellow working for the Institute by the name of Barney Oliver. He was a Hewlett-Packard research guy. He founded their research labs. Anyhow, he called up five people whom he knew, Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard. Everybody knows who they were.
Yep.
But also Gordon Moore, one of the co-founders of Intel, and Paul Allen. So I guess it was four people. Anyhow, so he knew Paul Allen personally.
Well, Paul came up with it, that's for sure. He stepped up to the plate. We're going to come back and take calls with Seth Shostak from SETI next on Coast to Coast AM. And Seth Shostak with us from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and you've got a great opportunity to talk with him. So we're going to take your calls this half hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Seth Shostak with us from SETI. He is Secret Door guest number 3, and I'm 0 for 3. He was able to disguise his voice. You tricked me, Seth.
Well, George, I'm surprised that I did, but anyhow, it's an interesting development, and I'll keep it in mind if it ever becomes necessary to get me out of a tight situation somewhere.
Absolutely. What about lasers, flashing lasers, to look for aliens?
Yeah, well, there are several projects to look for flashing lasers in the sky. And, you know, what's interesting about that is that, you know, it could be that some society is either deliberately trying to get in touch with us or just signaling to some buddy somewhere or to spacecraft they may have. So, you know, every 2 weeks they flash a laser, a green laser, a red laser, really doesn't matter. Nobody would ever know. I mean, we wouldn't know.
No, no way.
So that's about to change because there are several projects, including the one at the SETI Institute. It's called Laser SETI, which is, you know, pretty straightforward. And as we speak, that's being installed. One of the various stations for that is being installed in Hawaii, you know, on top of Mauna Kea, I believe, one of the mountains. Yeah, I think it's either Mauna Kea or Mauna Loa. I think it may be
Mauna Kea.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, anyhow.
It's a big telescope.
It's not the usual peak, I think. But in any case, it's up there. And, of course, having one isn't good enough. You have to have these things spread around the world. You really want at least six of them. But they're small. They're not terribly expensive. And if there are flashing laser lights going off, well, we'll find them.
Let's go to the phones now. First-time caller Bob is in Boston. Hello there, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Morning. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Yes, hi. I'm a person in the medical field and the science field. I'm just curious, and I don't mean to be confrontational here, but in the past 2 years, every day we've had credible sightings. We've got videos showing, you know, that report that came out, even though it wasn't conclusive. But we've got a lot of video. We've got credible pilots and stuff, especially off the coast of California. What's with all these microscopes and stuff and these telescopes that haven't seen a thing or mentioned one thing about it? I mean, I need a direct answer. So if you're answering, don't rope-a-dope on me here.
Fair enough. Go ahead, Seth.
All right, Bob. Well, look, here's the deal. Yeah, the official report said that there were a whole bunch of incidents that couldn't be explained or hadn't been explained, at least. But, you know, you may recall that several of them, or at least two of those videos, I think there were only three in total, but two of them showed what looked kind of like a peanut or an elongated shape, dark shape.
They call it the Tic Tac.
The Tic Tac. And, you know, it's in there in the field of view, and then eventually it twists a little bit. Now, keep in mind, Bob, that those cameras that made those videos were infrared cameras, which means that anything hot would appear to be dark. So there was something hot, you know, that was registering on those cameras. And if you just consider that there might have been a plane, you know, 30, 50, even 80 miles away, which you could see from 20,000 feet, these fighters were about 22,000 feet up, I think, you know, and it's there. And radars, you know, your radar isn't going to see it because it's not looking for anything that's 50 or 100 miles away. You don't see it on radar. You see it on this imager, this display from the cameras. That would explain it. I'm not saying that's what it was, but I'm saying that there are, you know, there are explanations that don't involve aliens. And it's also, I think you should consider the fact that it's a bit curious that these alien craft are only visible to the U.S. Navy when it's having exercises off San Diego.
Seth, did you ever have an opportunity to talk with the late J. Allen Hynek when he was alive?
No, I never talked with Hynek, lamentably. I would have liked that.
That would have been a great conversation. Yeah. I would love to have listened in on.
Yeah, well, he was an accomplished guy.
Bob, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Let's go next to Brendan in Austin, Texas. Hello there, Bren. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you, George, Seth, Tom, and everybody,
thank you, all the listeners.
I'll be super quick. How do you think that we could find non-carbon-based life? Anytime we're talking about SETI or looking for other types of life, we always look for human life because that's what we know, you know, carbon-based, water, oxygen. So how do you think we can look for people or things that are not like us?
That's a tough one, Brenda, because we don't really know how to look for even silicon-based life, which occasionally makes its appearance in science fiction. Silicon-based life was looked at by Isaac Asimov many years ago, and, you know, it could make molecules that would, you know, support life, that would be the basis of life, and they would be much more tolerant for high temperatures than carbon-based life, so maybe that's an advantage depending on the environment. But it's much, much harder to get big molecules out of something like silicon or germanium. These are all, you know, the same. These elements all have more or less the same properties as carbon. Look, there's a lot of carbon in the universe. It isn't to say the only kind of life is got to be carbon, but carbon is by far the best candidate. So, you know, it isn't arbitrary that we say, oh, well, it's probably carbon-based life forms, Captain. I mean, that's just the easiest way to do it.
Seth, your books, you've authored, what, 4 books to date?
Something like that, yes.
Still available?
I don't know. I don't try and buy them.
Huh.
Maybe I should. The most recent one is Confessions of an Alien Hunter. And
that was a great book.
Yeah, well, by the way. That probably is still available. Or you can probably buy it, you know, on eBay for the postage or whatever.
Next up, Bill, Los Angeles. Hello, Bill.
Hi, George.
Hey.
Seth, I share your kind of open-minded skepticism. I'm a former newspaper reporter. And I asked Bob Zimmerman recently on George's show the same question, and he kind of politely dodged it. And I'm with you on the tic-tac ambiguity. But what I think is less ambiguous is that photographed incident in 1952 over Washington, D.C., where newspapers, including the Washington Post and others, printed that our F-86 jets could not keep up with a fleet of UFOs going over the Capitol twice. And we know that MiG-15s that the Soviets had at that time were slower than our jets because our jets were shooting them down in the Korean War going on at the same time. So who could have built those craft?
Yeah, well, I actually happened to be living in the D.C. area at that time, and although I was a kid.
Did you hear about the story?
Yes, I did. I did. I was a kid. I don't think I was reading the newspapers, but my parents were, and they told me about it. But, you're a kid. You don't know what to make of that. That is a famous case, and, of course, there was a film, Earth versus the Flying Saucers, where the flying saucers came into D.C. and sliced up the Washington Monument and, over the Capitol, that kind of thing. But I don't know what the answer is. I'm not sure that anybody knows what the answer is. And, usually when they say that they're flying very, very fast, and that's said in a lot of these incidents involving UFOs, you got to be careful because you can only tell whether it's flying fast if you know how far away it is or you happen to know its measurements, if you know that it's 100 feet long or something like that. Otherwise, it may appear to be flying fast, just the way a bug that flies in front of your face is appearing to fly fast, but only if you don't know how far away it is. And so I don't know what the answer to that is. I don't think anybody does. There were even some radar observations, as I recall, in D.C., but it's one of those unexplained things.
Seth, how many full-time employees at SETI?
Well, the SETI Institute, has about 100 scientists.
Wow.
And, but most of them are not doing SETI. They're doing astrobiology. And,
okay.
And, things like Mars and, asteroids and comets and, and there are about 30, 35 support personnel, too. These are people who run the administration. They handle, anything that a business would have, any part of the organization that's necessary for running even a nonprofit, and we are a nonprofit. So that's roughly 30 people, but all the rest are scientists. You can go in there and you can talk to them, and they just love to talk about what they're doing.
You've got degrees in physics and astronomy, don't you?
Yes, I do.
How did you get hired on at SETI? How did that happen?
Well, it's not a very interesting story, so I'll try and limit it to four and a half hours here. But I was interested in SETI ever since I'd been a grad student because I happened to be reading a book by Sagan and a Russian physicist by the name of Joseph Shalovsky. And I was using some radio telescopes, and when I realized that these radio telescopes could also be used to look for E.T., I thought that was interesting. So I was interested in it for a long time. And when I lived in Europe doing research at a university there, I used their antennas to look for a signal. So I was sort of known in the SETI community. And when I moved to California in 1988, a year later, the people at the Institute heard that I was in town. And one of them called me up and said, "You want a job here?"
And you did. That did it for you.
Well, they called at the right time.
Andy's in New Jersey, east of the Rockies, of course. Hello, Andy. Go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Norrie, Mr. Shostak. Good to talk to you.
Hi, Andy. Good. Thank you.
Now, I had a question, because you had mentioned Oumuamua earlier, and there's this theory that advanced beings may disguise their craft as natural objects, like, asteroids or comets or whatnot. So my question is, What do you think about that? Is it far-fetched, or is it possible that we're seeing UFOs, but we're not identifying them properly because we think they're just naturally occurring objects in space? And do you think that we ourselves in the future, when we do build spacecraft that goes into the cosmos, will we also adopt that policy of making our spacecraft look like comets and asteroids and what have you? So that was my question. We might be seeing them right before our eyes, but not realizing that they're actual sentient beings. We might think they're just natural objects. So, yeah. Whatever thought you have. Thank you.
Well, Andy, I mean, obviously it's possible, you know, and I can't say that the aliens wouldn't do that, although I'm not quite sure what they're trying to protect themselves from if they do that, because that's expensive and it's probably not optimal in terms of the operation of the craft, you know, to sort of gussy it up to look like an asteroid. I mean, sometimes when you see a rock that looks like an asteroid, and when I say looks like, you know, that may be ambiguous as it is in the case of a Oumuamua, but a Oumuamua has the color of an asteroid, and you know, that's one of the few things we know about it, and you know, that suggests that it's an asteroid. But they could do it. They could do it. But if they have the technology to fly to somebody else's solar system, I don't think they need to do it. It would be like
there's no need to
Chris Columbus, you know, sort of camouflage his ships to look like a palm tree so that the people of the Caribbean won't be wise to what it was. But they didn't need to do that.
Let's go to Anchorage, Alaska. Richard's with us, west of the Rockies. Hey, Rich, how are you?
Good afternoon, or good evening, I guess it is.
Hey, did you feel that 8.2, by the way?
Yeah, the kettles rattled a little bit on the ceiling.
They did. I figured that.
I just looked at the website. In the last 24 hours, we've had over 65
Tremors.
Wow. All over. It's all over Alaska. But that's a standard day.
That's a lot. Okay, go ahead. You're on with Seth.
The question I've contemplated many times, if I was out there looking at Earth, where would I land?
Where would you land?
Yeah.
And you're a human or are you an alien?
No. You're an alien. You're looking at Earth as coming to it, as coming to this planet. As we spend hours and hours and hours contemplating a location to land on the planet that we're going to.
I'd go to Vegas.
That's as good an answer as any. I mean, the reason we spent all that time, Richard, contemplating where exactly to land is because, you know, if you make a mistake and land on a bunch of rocks with a spacecraft that we've built, you know, you might just destroy it. So that's – or you don't land in a place which has the subject that you're going to study. If you're going to find the kind of rocks that might tell you about life on Mars, you want to land in a place that once had water. So you look at the maps and you say, well, this looks like an old lake bed. I mean, that's why you do it. But if you were an alien, you could land anywhere. I suppose you would just land where there was a lot of evidence of some intelligent beings. Maybe you'd land on a freeway interchange or something. Those are very visible from space.
Let's go to Hal in Detroit, Michigan, my old hometown. Hi, Hal.
Hi, George.
Good to have you with us.
The question I have for Seth is concerning the laser SETI program. NASA is going to be launching their laser communication relay demonstration probably next month on STP-3. And I'm just wondering, with all the commercial space program taking off now, does SETI have any plans to put a similar device in the geosynchronous orbit to detect the lasers?
Yeah, well, I guess you're referring there, Hal, to the fact that all this laser development may interfere with a search for lasers from extraterrestrials, right?
Could be.
So, that's a problem, but there's not a heck of a lot you can do unless you have enough money to maybe, as you say, put the whole thing in orbit away from all these lasers, or the best place to put any instrument that's looking for ET, or for that matter, anything interesting in astronomy, too, would be the backside of the moon, because the backside of the moon is it's shielded from all the interference coming from Earth and presumably the laser networks, too. But obviously, to do that, you're talking at least hundreds of millions of dollars, and SETI doesn't have that kind of money.
No, it doesn't. Let's squeeze in Jeff in Ohio. Jeffrey, go ahead.
Hey, George, I had an opportunity several years ago to talk to an elderly gentleman who, in his surroundings, had a bunch of Air Force stuff. And I said, were you a pilot? He said, yeah. And after I got to talk to him a few times, I finally had the courage to ask him. I said, let me tell you something. You were up high in the Air Force, little green men. What do you know about them? Anything? I was expecting to dismiss. He says, oh, yeah, I know something. And he says he was the watch commander on the night of that Washington flyover back in the 50s.
Wow.
And that a radar operator had come to him and said, hey, I'm here, you know. And he saw it, and he says, yeah, it's not supposed to be there. So he scrambled a couple of his pilots up there, and they, you know, said they couldn't keep up with them. So, you know, the question was, well, how do you know they were going fast? Because they were trying to, you know, track them down and make visual, and they kept outrunning them.
That's a great story. Seth, we're running out of time, my friend, but one day I think you'll be on the air announcing the discovery, don't you think?
I hope so, George.
Me
too. I really hope so.
Thanks again, and thanks for stumping me. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
That's Seth Shostak. He was Secret Door guest number 3. Up next, number 4. Gosh, I hope I can find out who it is.